And every single school district in Oklahoma has openings for like literally hundreds of people, like Tulsa and Oklahoma schools, both of them. They're just looking for a couple of teachers. They are looking for hundreds. They have hundreds of vacancies. And that's a direct result of these poor political choices. Hello, and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. You may have noticed that I am doing the introducing instead of Rory this time, because I am doing an interview for the first time on this podcast. Rory and I are just running out of things to say. So as a sort of introductory approach to this, making sure that the technology is sorted out on my end, I'm interviewing my brother about Oklahoma. How are you doing today, Ed?
I'm great, thanks.
Edward has been my brother for quite some time.
Let's say exactly how long.
Come on now, we have no secrets here.
Let's invite that in the comments for people to guess.
Oh, of course. Well, that's always a fun job. I know, who's older, who's younger is also a fun question.
That's also a good one, yes.
Indeed. What year was it? When did you guys move to Oklahoma?
We moved to Oklahoma in the summer of 2021.
My understanding, moved there for a business opportunity. It was a lovely, lovely place, working out well. And then the Supreme Court decided to drop a bomb on the whole experience. This is something that I got wrong, very rarely wrong, as Edward can testify. But I actually got this very, very wrong on the channel. My assumption was that the largely Republican Supreme Court wouldn't be dumb enough to throw out Roe v. Wade. But it turns out they are a little more fanatically committed to anti-choice principles. That's what happened. And I think we'll start off, over the balance of this conversation, we'll talk about Oklahoma more generally, which is a fascinating place, a very interesting place. But I think we probably have to start off with how is it feel in Oklahoma? Like, what have the ramifications of the repeal of Roe v. Wade been?
There's a lot to say on this subject. I think it's worth saying what it was like sort of before to give a little bit of context for how things changed. So we moved to Oklahoma summer of 2021. My wife was recruited for a job there in the winter of 2021. We were all still, to a large extent, actually still sort of locked down in a lot of the world then, if we can turn the clock back, went to lockdown mid-March 2020, and most kids were still in remote school in spring of 2021. And there was, the context is that things were mostly locked down. We interviewed in Oklahoma. They put us up in a very nice hotel, and we were sold on sort of a new and exciting place to live. They had actually, be interested if the historical record bear this out, but did actually a really great job of rolling out vaccines in Oklahoma very quickly. And they did it in a typically Wild West sort of crowdsourced fashion, Oklahoma fashion, is, and they just did it all through Facebook. Like, there were no government websites created. It was like your local county, like, put on Facebook how many vaccines they had and where to go. And it was kind of a free-for-all, but it also, for those that wanted the vaccine, it was very successful. So, like, that was the context in which we interviewed for a job in March of 2021. And we were sold on Oklahoma City had just opened up a brand new contemporary arts facility. Oklahoma Contemporary is what it's called. There had just been a new exhibit opened up at a place called Factory Obscura, which is, for lack of a better way of describing it, sort of like a poor man's meow wolf. It's like an experiential walkthrough tactile museum, not dissimilar to the City Museum in St. Louis, but on a much smaller scale. So we were sold on a place that was very conservative in some ways, but also, I'll come back on this, like the assets and liabilities of this, but it's a little bit like a virgin landscape that you can do whatever you want with. Like, there is a lot of opportunity there. It's usually sold as like business opportunity, but we were sold on that there was a real hunger. There is a real hunger there for better arts and culture. I have a friend there who grew up in Oklahoma City, and he said literally they'd have to drive to Dallas to do anything, which is like a 4-hour drive. There's now things called the Tower Theater and Beer City Music Hall, the Criterion, like other music venues that exist now. But just 20 years ago, there was no, I mean, there were some honky-tonks, but there was no way to see, I'm trying to think of what, like a mid-level act that comes through.
This is a sort of a fascinating dynamic to a lot of the way that the United States works, specifically outside of parts of the United States that, say, viewers of Hollywood movies might be more familiar with, sort of the coastal areas, New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles. Is there's a lot of the country. You can see, if you see those maps that say where counties vote, usually right-leaning people are big fans of those maps of the United States that have like this sea of red and then these little blue pinpricks. And I guess Oklahoma City would be one of those little blue pinpricks. And it's been a fascinating dynamic. I think in a lot of ways, the urban regeneration of the United States is kind of an oversold story, but it's very true that after a number of dynamics in the mid to late, more late 20th century, where most U.S. inner cities sort of declined massively, I think Oklahoma City in particular has a particularly horrific experience with urban renewal, which you can maybe speak to. But I think there's this narrative of regeneration. And even in largely right-wing places, I think Oklahoma City is probably one of the more solidly conservative Republican states in the country. There's this urge, even on the part of conservative state or city leaders, to get more artsy people in, draw people in. It's this sort of Richard Florida idea that you needed to draw the creative class into your urban downtown to bring about revitalization. And what it sounds like you're describing is a place that had fairly serious successes doing that. But I think what's very interesting is the way that the repeal of Roe v. Wade is kind of blowing up that opportunity for a lot of these places. And is honestly, it's troubling because it honestly, running a video shortly talking about how all these fantasies about a U.S. Civil War are kind of ridiculous. Because every state in the union is actually much more interweaved and much more politically diverse than you'd think. And this repeal of Roe v. Wade is kind of creating a situation where people who believe differently, who have different approaches to their lifestyles, can't move to places like Oklahoma. And I think that's sort of a quite sad dynamic.
Yeah. So I'm trying to be careful to say there are a lot of positive things to say about the place. But yes, to jump to the chase, 9 months later, Roe versus Wade, 9 months after we moved there or so, Roe versus Wade was overturned. And you could tell the dynamic changed pretty instantly. My wife, when going to the doctor, has to use code words to talk about any sort of reproductive healthcare question. And there were all these stories on Twitter. Now, you know, Twitter's not necessarily the truth, but of just like all of these women at like the budget rental and the U-Haul place, like four women in line all talking to each other and all just saying like, yeah, we're just, you know, we're moving our families to a place that is, you know, kinder to women, to women's healthcare in general. And that's the important thing to people that I'm not sure everyone understands is that just by banning one form of women's healthcare, you are destroying women's healthcare in general, because basically you're lowering the caliber of anyone who wants to practice it. Anyone who then feels also, that also probably qualify people who are just afraid to practice it because of liability reasons. And so what you have is a tremendous brain drain that impacts doctors and thus all the other people who value doctors. And that's most people. You know, most people want to be able to get healthcare. At the risk of displaying my privilege too much, we are not unbelievably wealthy people, but we fly back to New York for any sort of routine healthcare because, like, for example, for myself, I'm not a woman, but I would go and see like the best. I have lower back pain. I go and see, you know, what was recommended as like the best physical therapist in Oklahoma City. This physical therapist just casually mentioned, "Oh, well, you know how we." Our bodies, you know, like we shrink about an inch and a half overnight because our spines contract. In fact, biologically, the opposite is the case. While we sleep, the watery sacs in our back expand and we actually get a little bit it's not like a full-edged nap, but we actually get a little bit taller in our sleep because the watery sacs in between our vertebrae, they get filled with water and they expand overnight. But this guy doubled down, the best physical therapist in Oklahoma City doubled down and tried to tell me something that was just false. That is not something that would happen in a doctor's office in Chicago or New York and Los Angeles, because that person would not have passed the local exams. But when you devalue women's healthcare, you devalue everyone else who wants to practice medicine with all of those people.
There's also another couple dynamics to this that are worth highlighting. The idea that, oh, you know, abortion is being banned or abortion is being threatened. So what people who lean right want to talk about, like, oh, you know, it's just these people who were irresponsible and they're 8 months pregnant and they want to murder their child. Da, 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 da. Like, that's always, you know, that's a ridiculous propaganda approach. But what people don't emphasize is just how, and I'm not an expert on this, but just how the inability to even look at procedures that might be related to abortion makes women who want to have children unsafe. It makes it so that they cannot, you know, if a complication arises with a woman who has a normal pregnancy and definitely wants a child, in Oklahoma, largely because a lot of these abortion bans are not being put together by doctors at all. They're being put together by legislators who have no idea what they're talking about. You know, a woman who has a complication, you know, while trying to give birth to a child she desperately wants, might be required legally to die rather than have her life be saved through a procedure to remove an unviable fetus. And there's that dynamic that isn't quite understood. And then there's also the very real sort of slippery slope dynamic that I believe came to the fore just a few weeks ago in Alabama, was it? Where the folks jumped straight from their victory against abortion to start talking about IVF, to start talking about routine fertility treatments that really anybody who attempts to have children in their 30s, you know, are very likely to be exposed to. I've certainly been exposed to in my social networks. You know, now that it's that sort of slippery slope going from, okay, we're going to restrict abortion to, like, now actually we're not so comfortable with IVF. Actually, we're not so comfortable with contraceptives at all, which is also an issue that's come up in the year and a half since Roe v. Wade. Now, this is phenomenal for the prospects of the Democratic Party because the Republicans have revealed themselves to be a bunch of weird lunatics. And if Joe Biden is reelected in 2024, he'll owe a lot of that to the Republican Supreme Court that opened up this horrific Pandora's box. But it's still incredibly dangerous for women and incredibly bad for the country.
Yeah, and something that I find so hard to understand is, on the one side, the conservative movement says we don't want government interference with our bodies and our decisions, and yet they are then also legislating with very little medical knowledge, exactly what people can and cannot do with their bodies, which just seems the opposite of what the conservative movement 15 or 20 years ago was about. A lot of these people, these legislators, they aren't necessarily evil. I think a lot of them have very good, not necessarily very good, but very within their rights to have religious views on the sanctity of life. But when they start mixing, you know, politics with healthcare, what you get is also a lot of confusion, where actually what you have is doctors who are just so afraid because of how poorly everything is worded. Like, I don't think that everyone who voted for these things doesn't believe in exceptions for rape and incest. And I don't think that all of them really do want a woman to die for lack of healthcare. But because of how ham-fisted it was forced through the legislature, it leaves doctors questioning what is legal at all. And just that fear makes it so that they don't want to touch it. They'll just cross that state off their list of places where they might practice or go to medical school. So it lowers the quality for everyone else.
Do you know the details of sort of how this works? So in June 2022, Roe v. Wade is struck down. Did Oklahoma already have sort of laws on the books that restricted things? What is Oklahoma like? Is it a complete ban? Do they have any exceptions? Like, what is Oklahoma Oklahoma's legislative approach to this?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't know the details. I know because I am a pretty avid news consumer, especially in Oklahoma. I have not heard of any prosecutions of women for seeking the healthcare or for providers like we have heard about in Texas so much. I will get in trouble with other progressive folks for saying this, but well, in particular in Oklahoma, or maybe it's called Canadian County, but the local district attorney, full disclosure, I was actually the photographer for her campaign, a name of Vicky Behana. She is a Democrat. But she has said like she will enforce the law, but I have not heard of her prosecuting anyone, at least in the Oklahoma City environs. And furthermore, I think it's worth giving a shout out to I think his name is Gentner Drummond, the state attorney general, who is a Republican and quite conservative. But also, he's made it very clear by what his priorities are, this is very low on his list of things to prosecute for before. And also, I do believe he has that. He will never prosecute a woman for any of this. This is showing how low my standards are for like a good politician. But when compared to the constellation of Oklahoma politicians, Gentner Drummond actually does seem to be a person who believes in like the law. For example, they're trying to force through religious education in Oklahoma. And Gentner Drummond, who is like a big evangelical, he's like, folks, no. Because if we allow all of these Catholic charter schools, then we're going to have to allow, you know, Church of the God of Satan charter schools. And that's like, there's a reason why we have separation of church and state. I'm a big believer. I really wish we could have prayer in schools. It is a bad idea. So sorry for that digression.
Well, I think that highlights a real problem with the Trumpification of the Republican Party. It's like, and you saw this contrast within the Trump administration. You had a lot of sort of old school right-wing wingnuts, very committed partisans, thinking of William Barr particularly, who was, I believe, the attorney general towards the end of the Trump administration. But like, still, they have just real basics of, and yeah, and like by the standards of 2000, these are incredibly, like the year 2000, you know, 24 years ago, these are people who are tremendously hard-charging and unscrupulous by the standards of the time. But this combination of sort of Trumpism and fanaticism, I don't believe Trump is a religious fanatic, but there are plenty of religious fanatics, have created a new breed of Republican politician that just has no respect for any of the legal maxims that we have. I think a William Barr recognizes that, yes, I'm going to be unscrupulous and I'm going to bend the laws to bring about my agendas, I think one of which would have been the overturning of Roe v. Wade. But you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It sounds like that's the Republican politician you're talking about here has a sense that like these systems exist for reasons and these systems are good for us, be we conservatives or liberals. And I do think there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who are losing touch with that and are looking at very short-term timeframes that are causing real damage to our constitutional order in the United States.
Yeah, a big example of that is Kevin Stitt, the governor of Oklahoma. He never voted before 2016. And Donald Trump, you can look it up. A true story. They do have records on this, or he admitted it. But Donald Trump was his political awakening. And he then ran for the governorship in 2018 and got reelected last year. Yeah, he's a perfect example. He just has no concept of separation of powers, of what government should be for, or certainly what I consider to be conservative ideas of what government is for. Like, he wants to use the government to actively, you know. It's so funny because it's what they always accuse the Democrats of, and yet it's actually them who are advocating for it. To talk more about the brain drain, because I don't want to, I know I said some Twitter references, but like my wife and I know a woman who was in charge of grants for a very large, there are a lot of large Oklahoma foundations because there's lots of Oklahoma money, there's lots of oil money there. And this woman was very public about, she moved to Colorado because she has a non-binary child and that child didn't feel safe in Oklahoma. That was about a year ago. And she was very public about why she left. And then just a couple weeks ago, I believe it's Nex Benedict or Bex Benedict, non-binary high school kid in Owosso, Oklahoma, was beat up at school and then died by a drug overdose the next day.
Oh, Jesus. I didn't realize that was Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's Owosso, Oklahoma. And so that's led, and I know other people who have, you know, non-binary or trans family members, and they're all just, you know, frantically looking at job opportunities elsewhere because of the overreach of government into people's private lives. And yeah, it is this new breed of Republican. Ryan Walters is also worth a Google, the education superintendent of public instruction, who is trying to ram through religious education in Oklahoma, who routinely puts on unbelievably embarrassing anti-trans tweets and also press releases from the Department of Education, from which about 300 people have resigned since he's taken over. And every single school district in Oklahoma has openings for like literally hundreds of people, like Tulsa and Oklahoma schools, both of them. They're just looking for a couple of teachers. They are looking for hundreds. They have hundreds of vacancies. And that's a direct result of these poor political choices.
Well, it's sort of Reaganism ad absurdum. The sort of Reagan movement that sort of came to power in the 1980s, and I think that both of us have had great sympathy with over, you know, in earlier periods of our political lives, you know, was all about being anti-government. And, you know, the scariest words in the English language are,
I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
But I think it's just 40 years of that, and emphasizing that message over and over and over again has caused a bit of amnesia or a sort of forgetting of one of the basic tenets or at least basic ideas of conservatism circa 1980, which was this idea that like the Constitution and legal limits on government are what we can use to refresh and save us from government overreach. And now it's been so corrupted and so overdone that it's just like we're gonna smash everything, including these constitutional protections, including these privacy rights that were the key weapons of the conservative movement against government overreach 40 years ago. And it's quite troubling to see. Part of it is just sort of, I guess, the natural corruption of any political movement that has too much power for too long. But it's I feel like it's running up against like real historical limits. Like the reason why Reaganism worked at all was because we had so much institutional weight and power built up in the United States over centuries, you know, since FDR. And certainly that institutional weight and power was abused in certain ways. So there was scope. There was the breaking down of some of these regulatory structures, you know, could bring real dynamism and real economic success in certain sectors. But now I think we're getting to a point where we're chipping away and chipping away, and we're beginning to get towards, you know, parts of the constitutional order, or constitutional system that are kind of vitally important. And we've gone far beyond the point of diminishing returns. And I think your experience in Oklahoma politics kind of illustrates, you know, how very real, very important things are falling apart. I mean, education would be one example. I mean, public education was a bipartisan priority for 100 years, for the entirety of Oklahoma's history. You know, going back, Oklahoma has had politics different from what we grew up about for its entire history. It's been a state for about 120 years now, something along those lines. But public education was always a bipartisan focus. Now, you know, year 45 of Reaganism or what have you, like it's getting to the point where the conservative movement is trying to actively destroy public education in Oklahoma. And that is
Ryan Walters, the superintendent of public instruction, the boss of all the teachers, has said he wants to register teachers' unions as terrorist organizations. He has also then doubled down on this. He also famously said, and this is all very well documented, it was okay to talk about the Tulsa race massacre of 1921 as long as race was not mentioned. So for those, any overseas viewers, in 1921, there was a massacre of Black people in Tulsa. It was known as Black Wall Street, a very successful African-American neighborhood in Tulsa. And it only really got a lot of recognition about 100 years later in 2021. It became finally a part of the school curriculum. And then Ryan Walters came to power and said, we can have this as long as we don't talk about race. He has since backed down a little bit on that. He's not backed down on any of his anti-trans rhetoric.
Well, just a quick mention, because I'm a comic book nerd. One of the big motivating forces behind that Tulsa Race Massacre becoming so acknowledged is a HBO series somehow pulling off a mix between the Watchmen comic book mythos and the very real and very horrible race riot that took place in Tulsa.
And the comic book before that, because I mean, I've always been a big student of history, but the two things that I knew about Oklahoma were the Tulsa Race Massacre, which actually was known as just the Tulsa Race Riot until a couple of years ago, also the murder of Osage Indians that has been documented in Killers of the Flower Moon, the book and the film. But just by your comic book influence was how I knew about Tulsa's history. But it is worth mentioning maybe a little bit on the historical background of Oklahoma. Is now a good time, Robert, for a little bit of history lesson? Or...
Well, yeah, it's fascinating. Visiting you guys in Oklahoma, I generally tend to buy history books from wherever I go. And I sadly don't have the details of the 400 years of Oklahoma history book that I read, present in my mind. But one thing that really stuck with me from that book is pointing out that Oklahoma has almost unique history among U.S. states. You've got a pretty standard history of really, I mean, to some extent, all U.S. states, but certainly most Western U.S. states. You know, a certain number of people move there. All of the indigenous are oppressed or kicked out in various different ways. This group of individuals sets up a state government. It's super corrupt. It's it's kind of the same. It's kind of the same story with, of course, local variations. But Oklahoma is a very strange, very different, very far outlier, in part because it's one of the last states in the continental United States that became a state.
Yep. Yeah, it wasn't a state until 1907, and prior to 1889, it was pretty much exclusively Native American reservations. So tribes from all over, including the Trail of Tears, ended in Oklahoma, so that was from the East Coast. But there are like 49 tribes in Oklahoma, including what are called like the five civilized tribes. They're actually still called that today, the five civilized tribes.
Very problematic name. Still used today. Yeah.
But they still use it. And coming from a
couple of white guys on a podcast is hard to.
Yeah. Or just coming from like an East Coast education that they were still calling it. That was, I found pretty remarkable. Lots of Indian tribes have been forced out of Oklahoma. And there was actually serious debate about whether it would become an Indian state called Sequoia. And this actually went very, very far before it eventually was turned into a state of Oklahoma in 1907. But even the settling of it by white people in the 1800s was, well, a lot of Indians did retain rights to what the government thought was horrible land, but then turned out to be have land that has a lot of oil. And for example, the Chickasaws in particular have done extremely well by that. So there's also an interesting dynamic in that it is one of the few states where the Native American population or First Nations, or as they and everyone else calls them in Oklahoma, Indians, have a lot of agency and a lot of power in government and in philanthropy.
Well, isn't the Oklahoma City baseball stadium the Chickasaw Stadium or something?
Yeah, it's the Chickasaw Breakdown Ballpark. Mm-hmm. The Chickasaws give a lot of money. Full disclosure, they give money to my wife's arts organization. I will say, walking around, you don't see, I think a lot of the Native American population stays to the reservations by choice. I don't think that they particularly want to be around these crazy white people in their cities so much. They're happy to invest in buildings with them, but they don't, and I can hardly blame them. Also, going back to the history of how it was settled, just the land run is worth noticing.
Well, I did want to say, I think it is a fascinating aspect of Oklahoma politics today and well worth expanding upon the the large sort of Native American power in Oklahoma. I'm not prepared to talk about this, but there's sort of fascinating recent Supreme Court decisions. I believe one that was very generous to Native Americans in Oklahoma, and then one that sort of clawed back some of the rights that had been given. But it is a tremendous, interesting, ongoing story. But it is worth emphasizing just the incredible high level of betrayal that the history involves into the 20th century.
Yeah.
The as you mentioned, the Trail of Tears from the southern United States, tremendous crime. This is one of the reasons we remember Andrew Jackson as a tremendous war criminal, one of the worst sort of presidents from a genocide perspective, is the Trail of Tears. And that was a whole bunch of indigenous people from Georgia, Florida, other territories being force marched to Oklahoma. And Oklahoma became sort of this is, I think, a loaded but fair term, dumping ground for the indigenous, not just from the East Coast, but over the ensuing decades. Sort of Trail of Tears was, I believe, the 1830s. Decade after decade, as the United States forced tribes out of more and more territory moving west, they were forced into Oklahoma. And it was known as Indian Territory. That was the official designation of Oklahoma for most of the 19th century. And this actually, for the regular viewers, this chimes nicely with the William McKinley episode we did a couple weeks back. That talks about sort of the closing of the U.S. frontier by the 1880s, by the 1890s. This is not just a historical theory. People at the time, elites at the time, were very invested in the idea that the frontier, the Western frontier, was a safety valve for the United States, where people could go get free land. And Oklahoma was the last land that was left. There's actually a Tom Cruise movie, I believe, that includes dramatization. I think it's a Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman film that, this is from the 90s, I think, that actually dramatizes these land races.
It's called the Land Run, the 1889 Land Run. So maybe a third or a half of the middle of the state was called the Unassigned Lands. And they advertised around the world as far as Germany and whatnot for to do a land run on a certain day at noon, and they fired a cannon, and people literally just like ran in from the borders, or they rode horses and wagons and staked out land. So Oklahoma City, for example, went from a population of 0 to 13,000 over the course of a week. It was the wildest way to sort of settle and divide up land ever conceived, and that is a very unique Oklahoma thing. And I think so permeates to this day in terms of the great assets and liabilities of the place. There remains, again, it's both beautiful and horrible, this feeling that you can just go there, claim something, and make it happen. It is a very, it's so funny, the legislature, they keep on saying, we keep on rolling back all regulations. We don't know why businesses don't want to move here. And the reason businesses don't want to move there is because CEOs can't ask their middle managers with kids in elementary school to move to a place that doesn't have education or women's health care. That's why businesses won't relocate there. But instead of working on that, the legislature was, how can we roll back more regulations, like lower taxes even more? But yes, taxes are very low. And for example, you do see a lot of people pursue the American dream there. I actually just worked on a play. I'm a theater designer about immigrants who came into Arkansas, and many of them settled in Oklahoma City. There's a huge, huge Vietnamese community there. I would say, like, when I was looking for a new warehouse for work stuff, most of the realtors that I dealt with were Middle Eastern descent. So there were a lot of Muslim immigrants from different countries in that side of the business. It is a place where you can move and say you're something, and in 5 years, you will be that thing as long as you show up to work on time. And you can't say that necessarily for all places. Now, that means that you have a lot of totally unqualified people doing jobs that they aren't qualified for. But it also does make it...
But what's more American than that, Edward?
But,
as long as they're not providing healthcare, I mean, God bless them.
Yeah.
All the jobs are BS jobs, you know? So it's good.
I'm trying to put a positive spin on the place because there are a few places of such raw opportunity. The problem is you will have to pursue it in a place where you cannot educate your children or have healthcare for your wife. But that Wild West mentality, that just like ride in and claim your land, definitely is still part of the culture today. It's interesting because where I specifically am, Oklahoma City, is like that. Tulsa is less like that. Tulsa was sort of settled by older folks and I believe has like a more refined philanthropic and arts culture, but has a lot less economic clout and is not growing at the rate of other parts of the state.
Tulsa, Oklahoma is a fascinating place. I've been tremendously blessed that my brother and his wife moved to Oklahoma because I'd never been. It was like one of, I think, three states in the continental United States I'd never been to. And there's a lot there. And Tulsa, Oklahoma is a fascinating place to visit. Do not envy the Chamber of Commerce there because their main tourist draws are an incredible suite of Art Deco buildings and race trauma, which is the aforementioned race massacre in Tulsa. And then in part, the reason why Black Wall Street existed there and also in the context of very rare economic opportunity for Native Americans, which is recently documented in the Martin Scorsese film. Part of that is in that particular period, the 1910s and 1920s, Tulsa was incredibly wealthy and became, because of that, one of the greatest, I think, international sites for the architectural movement of that time, Art Deco. So it's just a phenomenal downtown to walk down there. These incredible Art Deco masterpieces, and then you go see a very tastefully put together museum to a race massacre, and that's Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, Tulsa is very interesting. I would say the Boston Avenue Methodist Church is by female architect in 1921, and is the most amazing example of what was called sort of space deco. It looks like it's about to take off. It's an amazing thing. Also, talking more about race, which is hilarious that we have two East Coast white guys trying to explain race in Oklahoma. But another fascinating dynamic, for a number of years, the airport with the most travel in and out of it in the 1920s was actually Tulsa, Oklahoma. And that's purely because of the oil business. And that Osage land that is like 40 miles or so north of Tulsa is where Killers of the Flower Moon is set. But interesting fact, having it to do with it being Indian territory. Several Native American tribes actually aligned with the Confederacy of the South during the Civil War. And as part of their punishment, not only were they sent to Oklahoma, but also the slaves that they had, that those tribes had, were freed and given their own land. So there are actually remain today something like 13 all Black towns in Oklahoma. Including Boley, Oklahoma, that we visited, and it's a fascinating place. But they were thriving Black communities until essentially the railroads in the 30s stopped passenger service to a lot of these areas, and they're all very disadvantaged right now. But that is, you know, all Black towns. You'd have sundown towns in the American South where it's like African Americans weren't allowed after certain area, but literally these were towns where they were mandated to be all Black residents, which is crazy. A fact about Oklahoma.
That is a fascinating dynamic. I'm writing a book called American Empire, the First 100 Years, and I've got a preliminary chapter talking about, you know, genociding of the continent. And it is fascinating how certain indigenous groups sort of picking the wrong side in wars is a real dynamic in their dispossession. The Trail of Tears, Andrew Jackson's illegal, according to the Supreme Court at the time, dispossession of the Southern, more assimilated Native Americans in the 1830s, is a horrific crime that we spend a lot of time talking about, as we should. We don't talk so much about what was done to the Iroquois Confederacy up north, and also very, even more powerful, sort of an entity that had sort of figured it out how to negotiate between the British Empire, the United States, the French, what have you, or rather the colonial folks at that point. But
the problem was that the Iroquois Confederacy chose the British side during the Revolutionary War, which meant that during the actual fighting, the United States was able to vastly dispossess and slaughter their way through that territory in ways that are, you know, just sort of not ignored by the history books, but you kind of have to go looking harder than you have to for the Trail of Tears. And the status of the tribes who lived in Indian territory was tremendously knocked down by the fact that they chose the Confederate side in the Civil War, because a lot of them, as assimilated, very heavily air quoted, civilized tribes in the southern United States in the 1820s, 1830s, largely were slaveholders.
Yeah. And the contemporary ruling that you're referencing is McGirt, and unfortunately neither of us are really informed enough to speak about it, but essentially I think it has to do with tribal sovereignty in terms of prosecuting crimes, where tribal citizens can be tried. If someone is not a tribal citizen, can they be tried in tribal courts? And are members of a tribe, can they be tried elsewhere? Which is also very strange because Governor Stitt is very anti any tribal rights, even though he himself, and this is very common in Oklahoma, he is actually a member of a tribe, but does everything he can to work against them. He must have very complicated inner monologues about that.
Well, I mean, the question of indigenous rights is tremendously complicated in the United States more broadly. You're absolutely right. Neither of us are qualified to talk about McGirt, you said. What is it?
McGirt.
McGirt. Yeah, neither of us are qualified to talk about McGirt. But I do know that this is the analysis I've seen, that it would not have had, it was very unlikely to have been as sweeping as it was, as sweepingly pro-indigenous as it was, without the influence of Gorsuch, who is one of Trump's rabidly Republican appointees. And the question of indigenous rights does cut across ideological lines in really interesting ways, whereas you would imagine that caring deeply for the rights of the indigenous would be sort of a left-wing coded interest. But it does seem that Gorsuch, while being a standard bearer for the destruction of women's rights in overturning Roe v. Wade, apparently is tremendously dedicated to the concept of indigenous rights. And perhaps as part of his old school conservative commitment to contracts and this, that sort of thing, is bothered by the fact that we broke a lot of contracts with America's indigenous.
James Lankford, the senator from Oklahoma, or as he is often called, Slender Man, James Lankford is very much the same, has introduced lots of pro-Native American legislation that has all been quashed. And you do wonder if he just does it for optics. But if you take him at his word, also very interested in indigenous rights, which, yes, is not what one would expect. I do suspect it has mostly to do with, yes, the rule of law and saying, like, we said we would do these things, we should do these things. These people are right to ask for these things.
I've really enjoyed visiting Oklahoma City in recent years. It is just a fascinating place. The way that it does seem to sort of be. I mean, I wanted to mention just that urban renewal aspects of like Oklahoma City,
yeah,
in particular. That's a tremendously important part of U.S. history in the 20th century. That I think Oklahoma City is a particularly egregious example of. Do you want to talk to that?
Yeah. So
what urban renewal was, or?
Yeah. So Oklahoma is largely a petro state. I mean, it did have and does have some agriculture, a lot of livestock, but historically, since, you know, the teens, it's been oil has been the main business of the state. And so it has, the oil business is very cyclical. So it has boom and busts. And unfortunately, at the very top at one of the booms, the city fathers brought in the famous architect I.M. Pei, who only passed away a couple of years ago, to do a...
Is he the guy who did the Louvre?
Yes, the pyramid.
Mm-hmm. The pyramid at the Louvre is I.M. Pei. The National Portrait Gallery, the new wing, is, I believe, I.M. Pei as well.
I don't know about that, but I do think he did the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Famous architect. came in the early 60s and did a master plan for the city. And you can still see there's like this room size model that he did of Oklahoma City and what the city of the future would look like. And all cities at that time had, you know, it was evoked to have an urban renewal authority that would take land and pay people a token for it and knock it down for freeways or to clear ethnic neighborhoods or to build high rises. And it's funny, a common theme in Oklahoma is like elsewhere, but just more. Like I have a colleague and she's from Texas, Dallas, Texas. And I was asking her about the weather and she's like, yeah, you know, I feel like Texas is just about 8 degrees less hot in the summer and 8 degrees less cold in the winter. Like Oklahoma is just more extreme. And that definitely happened with the Urban Renewal Authority, which hilariously still exists and under the same name. They basically leveled the entire city. There are, you know, just a couple dozen buildings that are pre-1960s. And they tore down a lot of amazing architecture, all in the spirit of building the city of the future. Unfortunately, this all happened, and then there was a crash. But what
the 1980s oil price crash, right?
No, this was like a 1960s, like a regular sort of oil business dip. And where most cities would have stopped what they were doing because, oh, well, maybe we can't actually build all this up to replace it, Oklahoma City doubled down. And this is outlined in a book called Boomtown by Sam Anderson, where there just became like a mania for destruction. And they basically pulled down almost the entire city. There are just like a couple dozen buildings in total, and just like, you know, five or six of its equivalent to Tulsa's Art Deco masterpieces. Literally just like five or six that stayed up and everything else was torn down. And to this day, most of downtown Oklahoma City is just surface parking or empty lots, which is just wild. Because they just doubled down and they just kept on destroying everything. And even to this day, like I'm active in city council circles, and you know, if something might be a little difficult to maintain or something, like the immediate response is like, well, let's tear it down and replace it with surface parking. People not understanding that, you know, just creating more parking does not actually add value to the city, whereas perhaps renovating a structure or replacing the structure with something useful might be a better use.
Just to add a little bit of historical context, urban renewal was a response to essentially the suburbanification of the United States. A lot of people in the aftermath of World War II, largely white people who could get mortgages or what have you, supported by the federal government, would, you know, sort of fled out to the suburbs. We were raised in the suburbs. Most people we know were raised in the suburbs. There was a huge dynamic in the United States, which left a lot of probably perfectly serviceable and usable housing and buildings within the urban cores simply unoccupied. And the big answer was, well, let's tear all these down and perhaps maybe we'll put up some large housing high rises. This is this generalized program of urban renewal that is, I think, largely lamented throughout the country now. Nobody really thinks it was a good idea. But I can definitely testify to what the Boomtown book was saying, what my brother is saying, that like Oklahoma City is on an entirely different level. It is so you can see pictures of there was vibrant downtowns, interesting old buildings, and it's almost all of it is gone. And it is quite stunning. I do think to end this on an incredibly depressing note, I think we can't really talk about Oklahoma City without talking about the attack in the 1990s, without talking about in part because I think it actually has some relevance. Oklahoma City is the site of the largest act of domestic terrorism in U.S. history. In the 1990s, I should have the exact date in front of me, but I do not. In the 1990s, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, is that
correct?
That's
right, yeah. I should know the year as well, but I don't.
It was April 19th, 1995, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. I think it might have a little bit of
contemporary relevance, because I think it's probably the logical end point of our current era of somewhat fervent, overarmed right-wing politics.
Yeah, I think that Timothy McVeigh has a lot of parallels with Trumpism. You know, his desire to spark a race war, his desire to, I mean, essentially just tear everything down. Yeah, ideologically, you definitely see him marching with a torch at Charlottesville and being called a good person on both sides.
I think there's a real, at some point, I'm not sure when this podcast will come out, either shortly or a couple weeks back, I'm running a video sort of poo-pooing a YouTuber who was calling for a civil war, talking about how, oh gosh, you know, the things are so divided right now. And what I think is forgotten is that in the aftermath, to some extent, what we're seeing in U.S. politics is the long-term fraying of the Cold War consensus in the United States, the sort of the consensus that was put together, the right-wing fusionism that you could have between sort of capitalist haters and government haters. But, you know, so the long-term disarray, long-term disintegration of that is what we're seeing in U.S. politics today. But there was a lot of, you know, instant short-term effects. The fact that the Cold War was all of a sudden over, and then we had this Democratic baby boomer hippie president. I mean, Bill Clinton, hard to think now, but Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton were actually quite young by the context of recent presidents in the 1990s.
They're still younger than the current president.
Oh, geez, that's incredibly depressing. They were seen as this threatening thing, and there was a much more vital than it is now, quite frankly, armed militia movement in the United States in the 1990s. The Michigan Militia, in particular, was a famous example. Ed and I, our family has a real connection to Michigan. But, you know, the Michigan Militia and their being out in the woods and doing military stuff was a real factor in U.S. politics in the 1990s, much more serious, much more divided, really, I think, than the U.S. Political scene today. And how that all ended...
I'd push back on that, but continue.
How that all ended was with the Oklahoma City bombing. So I don't think that the United States is heading towards civil war, but I really fear that we are perhaps around the 2024 election headed towards some signal act of horrific political violence similar to Oklahoma City. And then I think this era of, you know, hyperpolarization and everybody's armed and civil war is coming will disappear.
Yeah, I think the broader fears of like a civil war dissolution are pretty unfounded. I mean, for example, like Kevin Stitt was, you know, had a landslide victory in his reelection campaign, and he won 59% of the vote. That means that 41% of the people did not vote for him. So that is 4 out of 10 people. You know, I don't think that those 4 out of 10 people are going to be okay with Oklahoma, you know, seceding. You know, Oklahoma also can't survive without federal largesse, as most of the southern states or states that, aside from Texas, all the other states that we, you know, we fear of seceding or civil war, they can't possibly support themselves without the other states. So it's just foolishness. And that's important to remember also. Yes, sure, there are counties where 80, 90% of people will vote for one party or the other. But in the places where things get done and large, you know, considering most agriculture is automated now, you know, in the cities, it's, you know, you can't have that sort of movement when you only have the support of 6 out of 10 people. So that's pretty unfounded. But I definitely share your fear that of just because we are so unbelievably armed to the teeth, the idea of, yes, a big, violent political moment, I think, is pretty inevitable just by the number of firearms around. But the Oklahoma City bombing is memorialized in Oklahoma City by what I think is one of the best pieces of public architecture. It's very well done.
It's beautiful.
It's a great memorial. There's also that can be experienced outside. There's also a memorial museum that is pretty well done, pretty visceral. So you have to sort of be prepared to relive part of that. Unfortunately, there was a thing after the bombing called the Oklahoma Standard. So Oklahoma City, you know, got a couple thousand law enforcement, federal, local law enforcement in town, is the hunt for Timothy McVeigh. And they all had something that was a term that many Americans knew, which was called the Oklahoma Standard for a while. And that was that they were also impressed by how they were treated. These FEMA workers and police from all over the state and from Texas and whatever. And for a while, that was like a phrase that people knew. And unfortunately, for Oklahoma, that state, that phrase has got out of
The Oklahoma Standard, meaning just like the level of politeness and like,
yeah, the amazing hospitality was what the Oklahoma Standard meant, like graciousness and hospitality. And that is certainly the farthest thing from current Oklahoma politics. And I think it's something that it's great that most, I think, school children at Oklahoma go to the memorial and see. And hopefully they will remember the Oklahoma Standard, and one day they will be able to reclaim it. That would be nice.
Well, I think that's probably a solid place to end, unless there's any closing thoughts you have about Oklahoma and what it's like to live there.
You hinted on, I feel like I've said a lot of negative things, but it is a fascinating place to visit. The First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City is one of the few museums about Native Americans actually put together by them. So it's fascinating in that way and well put together. A lot of the exhibits are done around a simulated fireplace where you hear people telling stories. And, you know, it took me, you know, this white guy from the East Coast, it was like a big revelation. Like, this is how these stories are supposed to be told. This is, you know, how this history was passed down. And so it's fascinating to see that. There's also, on the opposite end of the spectrum, the Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, which is about a half the size of the Metropolitan Museum in New York, except it's all just cowboys.
Fascinating.
Yeah. There is it is a fascinating place to visit. Yeah, I just think it's worth mentioning that.
Well, I feel like Mom would. I feel like Mom would like us to mention that. Isn't there? Is it the First Nations Museum where they saw fit to include a quote from our ancestor?
Edward Everett is positively quoted in the First Americans Museum,
which is it's nice to claim, you know, an ancestor from the 19th century who actually, you know, judged well by history.
And I think was voted out of office for it.
That'll happen. That'll happen. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much, Edward, for coming on and being the first guest on the More Freedom Foundation podcast.
I'm so honored.
Yeah, it's been a good talk, and I hope to see you soon, seeing as how you're on the other side of my apartment.
Sounds good.
All right. Yeah.
Bye.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.